Now I'd like to welcome the president of St. Anselm College, Dr. Stephen DeSalvo.
Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to St. Anselm. Welcome to the home of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. And thank you for joining us for tonight's William W. Treat Lecture. It's great to have everybody here. Before I begin, I'd like to ask that you please silence your cell phones and any other devices. As a reminder, we are here tonight to listen and to learn. Any disruptions during this event will force us to remove the individual. As you may know, New Hampshire has a long tradition of political and civic engagement, and we're always very happy to take part in that process. I would like to extend a special thanks to our constitutionally speaking partners for making tonight possible. New Hampshire Humanities, the New Hampshire Institute for Civics Education, the New Hampshire Supreme Court Society, and the Warren B. Rudman Center for Justice, Leadership, and Public Service. It's also my pleasure to welcome former NHPR host Virginia Prescott back to New Hampshire for tonight's event. It's good to have Virginia back from Georgia, where she now resides. I'd also like to give a very warm welcome to United States Senator Susan Collins from Maine. For the past 5 years, Senator Collins has ranked as the most bipartisan member of the United States Senate. There is no one better to be here talking about civility and compromise in politics than Susan Collins. We're very glad the senator could be here tonight, given how busy her last few weeks, few days, few hours have been. I would also be remiss if I didn't recognize the incredible work of the staff here at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, Ann Kamen and her team under the leadership of Neil Levesque, who does an extraordinary job day in and day out making sure that the Institute continues to thrive and have a special place here, not only in New Hampshire, but in the United States. So with that being said, I would like you to join me in welcoming a good friend, Joe McQuaid of the New Hampshire Union Leader, to introduce the William W. Treat Lecture and our speakers. Thank you.
He said I got off easy. I'm also on the Civics Board. This event would not be possible without William Treat, and I was lucky enough to meet him, and I think he would definitely be particularly pleased that Senator Susan Collins is here tonight. Bill Treat was a native of Maine, but we claim him for our own in New Hampshire, where he had a long and distinguished career, really several careers. He was a lawyer, a banker, a judge of probate, a diplomat, and a stalwart Republican. Presidents Reagan and Bush named him to the United Nations as a representative, where he focused on international human rights and served in Geneva on the Subcommittee for Prevention of Discrimination and Protection of Minorities. At home, he founded the National College of Probate Judges. He was chairman of the State Judicial Council and wrote the book on probate law. He chaired the Administrative Committee for District and Municipal Courts and authored a study that resulted in a reorganization of the local court system in New Hampshire. Writing in the Union Leader upon the judge's death in 2010, a friend noted, "Judge Treat brought civility to politics, humanity to our probate court system, and ethics to business. He showed a community, state, and country how one man can make an impact on every aspect of his life." This friend also quoted entertainer Pearl Bailey telling a UN visitor that any friend of the judge was a friend of hers. I will add the judge was also a friend of the late publisher of the Union Leader, William Lowe. We have here tonight, in addition to members of the Treat Foundation, we have a couple of representatives from the Supreme Court Society, Chief Justice Robert Lynn and Associate Justice, sorry, I still call her Bobby Hans, it's Bobby Hans Marconi. And we're honored to have a certain retired member of both the New Hampshire and United States Supreme Courts, the Honorable David Hackett Souter. Can't believe he's going to go back to work. Susan Collins is Maine's senior United States Senator. She was first elected to the Senate in 1996. She chairs several committees. She has earned a national reputation for working across party lines. She is the founder of the Common Sense Coalition, a bipartisan group of senators who helped end two government shutdowns. She is honorary co-chair of the bipartisan No Labels effort. Known for her Maine work ethic, Senator Collins has never missed a roll call vote, casting more than 6,700, and she probably has one or two coming up. The senator is joined, as President DeSalvo said, tonight by Virginia Prescott, whom we welcome back to New Hampshire, where she added so much to New Hampshire Public Radio. She is now with Georgia Public Broadcasting. The two, Senator Collins and Virginia, will chat for approximately 40 minutes and then take a few audience questions. Welcome, Senator Collins and Virginia Prescott.
Thank you so much for being here with us tonight.
It's my great pleasure. I've learned a lot about William Treat. The most important facts are that he was born in Winterport, Maine, and that he was a graduate of the University of Maine. So I feel very honored to be here.
Well, as we know, our conversation tonight is focused on civility and compromise in democracy and in our government. And I know very well that everybody here has a big question on their mind, and it is, of course, the senator's health care bill that you proposed. So we're going to get to that as much as possible. I do have a number of questions that people have submitted beforehand. I'm going to try and work those in as much as possible. But first, to get a little bit of history on you, Senator, you grew up in Caribou. Your parents were both mayors of Caribou, Maine. And I feel like your career in many ways has been sort of a window on our political history of the last 40 years. You were a congressional intern during the Watergate hearings. You were a senator through the impeachment hearings of Bill Clinton. You were senator standing during 9/11, the George W. Bush administration, the Trump administration, and a witness to the rise of more pugnacious bipartisan politics. How did we get here?
Well, that's a very good question, because if you look throughout history, there have always been times of great contentiousness, argument. I remember in 1856, a congressman from South Carolina came to the Senate and caned the senator from Massachusetts. So there have been, I suppose, some worse times that we can look back on. But in my time in the Senate, the level of polarization and sheer ugliness and lack of civil discourse has been unprecedented in the last few years. And I think it has a number of causes. It used to be when we would have very vigorous debates on the issues, and we always did, that people's motives weren't questioned. It wasn't assumed that they, or there weren't charges that they were bought by somebody or some group. And what we've seen is the rise of these outside, highly ideological groups that demand 100% compliance with 100% of their views, 100% of the time. And woe to you if you deviate, much less try to find a middle path forward. And one reason that I agreed to become a co-chair of No Labels is I wanted there to be more of a voice for those who are in the middle.
You and Senator Joe Manchin are honorary co-chairs of No Labels. So, but your history, how did you get here?
How did I personally get here?
6,700 votes later, we've got a question here about this willingness to part with the party lines. And again, ranked the most bipartisan senator for 5 years, known as a moderate, a centrist, a problem solver. We have a question here. Do you feel you are in a unique position that allows you to act in a bipartisan manner, or do you act in a bipartisan manner because you feel it is your duty to do so?
That's a great question. It's really just part of my DNA. I grew up, as you mentioned, in a household where I learned that giving back to your community, your state, and your country was really important. Both of my parents were very active in public service, and my father was a World War II veteran who fought in the, was wounded in the Battle of the Bulge. My mother was the chair of the University of Maine System Board of Trustees, as was my grandfather, and as is was my brother. My father was a four-term state senator. My grandfather was in the state senate. It's truly, I grew up in a family.
Did you have
family.
Any other choice?
Exactly. And most important, I learned from my parents that you had no right to complain about what was going on if you weren't willing to get involved. I also had wonderful role models in Margaret Chase Smith, whom I met when I was a senior in high school, and in Bill Cohen, former Senator Bill Cohen, for whom I worked for 12 years.
Somebody asked, Jackson from Newport, Maine, by the way, I should give proper credit to Mainers, how does it feel to be the Margaret Chase Smith of our generation?
Well, that's a very kind question from Jackson, who I met at the reception, and honest, I didn't ask him to write that. But I would never claim that.
Oh, yes, no, I see
that.
It says love, Mom.
I would never claim that title, but I did meet Margaret Chase Smith as a senior in high school, and I remember being so impressed that she
Who
and
she?
Ed Muskie were my senators. And, you know, that was back in 1971 when young girls and women did not necessarily understand that you could be whatever you wanted to be. And I remember leaving her office, and I certainly didn't think that I would ever be sitting at her desk, which I do on the Senate floor. But I do remember thinking that women could do anything after meeting with her.
Well, this also, a bipartisan senator, gives you extreme pressure, especially as you're going through right now, but also a pivotal role, a very powerful role. You and Senator Lisa Murkowski, for example, you are the two who get the call after Justice Kennedy tendered his resignation from the president to meet with them and call. Do you think that you could, you know, offer this as an example for other senators that if you really want to get heard, actually act in a bipartisan manner? Is there something to that?
I do think there's something to that, but I think it goes beyond being able to influence the outcome of legislation. It is how we ought to operate. It is fundamental to our democracy to try to find common ground. I think that one reason public confidence in the institutions of our democracy right now is so low is that we've become so divided. And Congress reflects our nation. We see people living and having friends who just believe what they believe and less of an openness to hear and respect the views of others. And I think that's dangerous for our democracy. That is what the Russians are trying to exploit through their disinformation campaign. They're trying to sow the seeds of mistrust, doubt, and hatred in this country to weaken our democratic institutions.
Well, you have been praised as a rare species, like an exotic bird near extinction, for being a bipartisan senator, a voice of reason, targeted as a villain, called, of all things, a closet Democrat, the perhaps worst. So what does that feel like for you, however? Because you have been called a traitor to your party. You have been villainized. So what does it feel like to stand up to that opposition?
Well, I have to say that the current time that we're in right now has been the most difficult of all the years that I've been privileged to represent Maine and to work for the good of my state and our country. It has been an extremely difficult and ugly period in our history. But I feel very fortunate to represent a state where people value independent judgment. It doesn't mean that people don't have strong views, and obviously we have those on the far left and the far right, as do most states, who are never going to be happy with someone who tries to find the middle ground, or maybe with one side one day and the other side the next. But I believe that my job is to weigh the facts and do what I think is right, regardless of the consequences. But I do wish that the middle were bigger in the Senate right now. And believe me, the names that you mentioned, that's nothing compared to what I've been called in the last couple of months.
Ooh, how does that, I know.
I can't say the words I've been called in the last couple of months, but I'll tell you, it's worse for my staff. It really is.
Well, of course, they're on the sort of front line of this, but you are the public face of it. How does that influence your decision? Threats, for example. Is that something that, you know, you're known as a person who considers things on a case-by-case merit, but if you are being pressured, you've had some consistent protests, this is a highly emotional issue for people because Judge Kavanaugh is, many people I'm seeing from these questions suspect that he will overturn Roe v. Wade, and I want to talk to you about that. But the idea that based on the threats that you're getting, does that influence your decision? In other words, is that the exact wrong way to go about it?
It is exactly the wrong way to go about it. I welcome input from people who have different views from mine or who agree with me, or if I'm undecided or trying to influence my decision making. I think that's how you get to good decisions. But threats are the worst way to approach me. An example is this crowdfunding effort that several people are involved in that has raised $1.3 million. And in what I view as a quid pro quo, I mean, I really wonder whether it violates the bribery statutes. They have said that if I vote for Judge Kavanaugh, they will refund the money to the donors. If I vote against him, they will give the money to my 2020 opponent. And that sure sounds like a quid pro quo to me. And I think that's just wrong. And that shouldn't be what our country is about. And in the end, I have to be able to look in the mirror and say, I did what I thought was right.
But that campaign also gets a lot of attention, obviously, and this is a way that ordinary citizens are looking at influencing the people who are representing them. So is that crowdsourced money, is that any different? We got this question from someone on social media, we posted that we were going to be speaking with you, said, you know, is that any worse than money spent by PACs or corporations or lobbyists? What would be a better way for constituents to reach you?
Well, first of all, believe me, they have not hesitated to reach me on this issue. I have 6 offices in the state of Maine, plus my Washington office. I'm out and about all the time, and people don't hesitate to come up to me, no matter whether it's an official event or if I'm at the grocery store or at Mass or anywhere else. So, and I think that's a great thing about representing a smaller state, is people do have direct access. I meet with thousands of constituents. So I think that is a better way. I think there's the difference, I would say, between regular campaign contributions. And by the way, I would have far more disclosure and of these issue ads. I don't know who these groups are and who's paying for all the television ads on both sides of this issue. And I think there should be far more disclosure. But for normal campaigns, you can go to the FEC, put in my name, and see everybody who's contributed to me, what their occupation is, how much money they gave. There are campaign limits and contribution limits. And that is very different from saying, if you take this official action, then this pot of money will go to your opponent. And if you don't do what I want, then it goes to the opponent. If you do what I want, then it is refunded. That to me is totally different.
So
and
that
it doesn't
have
work.
The disclosure.
That's
it
not doesn't
working.
Work. That's
but,
not
so
working.
What does work? How do you approach a decision? Do you look at polling? Do you look at how many calls and tabulate what's come into your office? Do you have conversations? How does that work for you?
Well, let me use the elephant in the room as the example. I put together a team of 19 attorneys, and many of them were from the Congressional Research Service, Legal Division. They are smart, they are nonpartisan, to help me digest the speeches, the law review articles, and the decisions of Judge Kavanaugh. 4 of those attorneys, 2 are on my staff of the 19, and 2 are former staff members, one of whom clerked for Justice Kennedy and is a law school professor now, one of whom is a very smart attorney from the state of Maine who I've worked with over the years, and he worked for me at one point. So I had them help me come up with what questions to ask. I also met with countless constituents on both sides of this issue. The other night, I spent an hour when I was driving from Portland to Bangor, which is 2 hours, so I spent half the time on the phone talking with a group of 5 people who are representing different groups who were opposed to the nomination. I've met with just countless citizens on both sides of the issue, and of course, my phones have been inundated with calls. Unfortunately, with many of those calls, they've been from people from out of state. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I don't care what people from out of state think. I love to know what New Hampshire thinks, for one. After all, you have the first presidential primary, right? But that's a joke. just don't want to start any rumors tonight. But the problem with being inundated with out-of-state calls is all these offices are set up to help people with Social Security, with VA benefits, with getting comments to me, and people just can't get through. I've had protesters at my house. There's another protest that's going to happen Sunday morning, I'm told, and protests at all my offices. I don't think protesters really convey much. I think it's much more thoughtful to do an email, a conversation, a letter. And I pay attention to that I'm obviously very interested in what my constituents think.
Well, this is a deeply emotional issue. And your position, let's just refresh your position on reproductive rights for women.
I am for Roe v. Wade, which was reaffirmed in... which was reaffirmed in Planned Parenthood versus Casey 26 years ago. Roe v. Wade was in 1973. I believe Justice Souter was the co-author of the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision, and which reaffirmed Roe, and that is my position. I am for a woman's right to choose. I found it ironic that Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and I have continually saved funding for Planned Parenthood, for example, which is running pretty tough ads against me in the state of Maine. But I want women to have access to the services provided by Planned Parenthood, so that's not going to affect my future votes on the funding. So that is my position.
But this is a personal position.
Right.
And how you have said clearly, in fact, there's a question, you've said that you would oppose a Supreme Court nominee who would overturn Roe v. Wade, but that Brett Kavanaugh is not that nominee. If you vote to confirm Mr. Kavanaugh or any other SCOTUS nominee, and he later votes to overturn key parts of that decision, will you resign?
Well, first of all, let me back up and give you the whole quote that I said. And that is, I said that I would not vote for a nominee who demonstrated hostility to Roe v. Wade, because that would indicate a lack of respect for the established precedent of the court and for the principle of stare decisis and horizontal stare decisis. So that's the second part of the quote that is always cut off and never quoted. When I first met with Judge Kavanaugh in my office, we met for more than 2 hours, and I subsequently had another hour conversation with him on the phone last Friday. But the first meeting, which I believe was longer than any other senator met with him, and I had a list of questions, and we spent a great deal of time talking about Roe v. Wade and talking about respect for settled law. And I asked him specifically, is it sufficient for 5 current justices to believe that a decision was wrongly decided in the first place to overturn it? And he said, no. And I said, what about a decision that was decided in 1973 and reaffirmed 26 years ago? And he said the age of the decision does matter because of reliance interests that has been placed on a decision. And he also said, I'm not a rock the boat kind of judge. I believe that precedent is rooted in the Constitution. To my knowledge, he's the first nominee to say that, and he reveres the Constitution. And he said that, as I mentioned, the age, the reliance, and the fact that it had been reaffirmed and was based on earlier decisions all mattered. Now, he is not going to say to me whether or not he agrees with the original decision. And to quote Ruth Bader Ginsburg at her hearing, no hints, no previews, no forecasts. Those nominees do not say how they're going to rule. By the way, the very first question that I asked Judge Kavanaugh was whether anyone at the White House or at the Federalist Society or anywhere else had asked him for a commitment on any legal issue or how he would rule. And he said, absolutely not. And that mattered to me because of some of the comments that the president has made, which has put Roe v. Wade in play. So that's the reason for my belief. When he talks, as did his answers to me, were very similar in many ways to those given by Justice Kagan and Justice Roberts, both of whom I supported, because he talked about precedent as being part of a bedrock principle of our judicial system that gives predictability and stability to the law and to our whole judicial system.
But Justice Kagan was not on the list that the Federalist Society composed and gave to the president who on the campaign trail said that he was going to put somebody on the Supreme Court who would overturn Roe v. Wade.
So let me address that issue, because that's why I asked him about, I actually asked him, did he get interviewed by, it's either Leo Leonard or Leonard Leo, I can never remember which, the name of the president of the Federalist Society, or anyone from the Federalist Society, and he said no. But also, he was not on that original list of 25 names that was released during the campaign. There's one judge on that list who I definitely wouldn't vote for. I voted against him when he was nominated by President Bush for the circuit court. So, and it had to do with Roe and his comments on Roe. So I think it's significant that Judge Kavanaugh was added to the list later, and he was not on that initial list. But nevertheless, because of the president's comments, that's why I spent a great deal of time probing him on this very important issue, which matters a lot to me.
Of course, you had that conversation with him before the allegations from Dr. Christine Blasey Ford came out against accusing him of a sexual assault 36 years ago when they were both students. Now, the question of whether the impasse of this week, because we are talking about civility and compromise, was whether or not Dr. Ford would testify Monday. You offered, it could be in public or in private. Now, Dr. Ford is indicating that she would be willing to speak next week. Now, I think it was perceived that her refusal sounded like a green light for a lot of people to go ahead and push forward with the Judge Kavanaugh nomination. But what do you say if she says, I won't be ready on Monday? Is that enough to push forward? Is the schedule more important than that?
If Professor Ford says that she's not ready to come on Monday, then she's offered, I think, Wednesday or Thursday, then to me, we should say, fine, come Wednesday or Thursday.
What would your colleague say?
Well, this is what I've recommended to my colleagues, and I've spoken with many of them on the Judiciary Committee, in leadership, and friends in the Senate to recommend that. I very much want to hear from Dr. Ford and to hear what she has to say, and then what I want is for both Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh to come to the committee and testify under oath. I think that would help me make an assessment, and that's what I think should happen. And I don't think, if she can't be there Monday, then invite her for Tuesday, invite her for Wednesday, invite her for Thursday. I don't think we should be stuck on a particular day. Now, I will say that, and one of the reasons that I talked to Judge Kavanaugh last Friday is on Thursday, I found out about the anonymous letter, and I read it's still under it's still embargoed, or it's called committee sensitive. So I can't tell you the specifics of it, but I can tell you a couple of things that have become public. One is it's dated July 30th, and it refers to a conversation between Dr. Ford and a congresswoman from California that occurred on July 6th. So I am concerned that the information did not come forward sooner so that the judge could have been questioned about it in either a public or the closed session. But we are where we are, and I think that they should both come forward now and testify. I suggested, though I don't think this is going to happen, that the counsel for each question the principal. In other words, Judge Kavanaugh's counsel would question Dr. Ford. Dr. Ford's counsel would question Judge Kavanaugh. That way, I think we would have more continuity in the questions, solicit more information, and have a more in-depth examination. Another alternative is for both sides, the Democrats and the Republicans, to hire outside counsel to conduct the questioning so that you would have, I think you'd get more information. That was done in the Watergate hearings. And I very much remember a young Fred Thompson asking Howard Dean the pivotal question of, were there tapes, for those of you old enough to remember. And so I think that can be an effective way to elicit information. So that's what I would like to see happen. I do want to absolutely denounce the threats that have been made against Dr. Ford and also Judge Kavanaugh's wife. There's just no place for this in our society, and we've got to start speaking up and being united in condemning such behavior.
What will you be looking for, listening for, searching for in body language, in manner, in the way of speaking to tell, because you know that was one of the things that Dr. Ford's lawyer said, that this could easily devolve into a he said, she said situation. We know from Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, both of them pilloried in front of the press. What will you be looking for in that hearing?
Well, first let me say that the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill questioning by the Senate was a disgrace. I mean, it really was. And it was unfair to both of them. I thought so at the time, and then when I saw some excerpts recently that refreshed my memory, your mouth just hangs open. And so that, we've got to avoid that kind of atmosphere. And I talked to a judge I knew, I talked to a state trooper, a prosecutor, an FBI agent recently about how do you assess credibility. Maybe Justice Souter could give me a few tips on this, because that's hard. But ultimately, that's the job that we're going to have to do in this case. And I think you look at detail, you look at what you know about the person, their background, is there a pattern? Questions like that, but it's why I feel so strongly about seeing both of them as opposed to just reading about the allegations. I think you get a much better sense if you hear the person And so that's what I will do.
Well, we know from the Me Too movement and all that has been exposed about women coming out about sexual assault and harassment PTSD in many, many cases, that the descriptions can be obscured. The way that people remember things, especially after many years, can be really difficult to assess. So with that in mind, that stands up to a different kind of scrutiny than probably somebody appearing in front of the Supreme Court and making a case. So I'm wondering for you, we've got a question here from the audience. Would you hire someone to your staff with a credible sexual assault charge?
Well, not if it's credible. Of course not. But what we need to find out here is, we don't know enough yet. So I can't reach that conclusion. And that's why I'm eager for the hearing to go forward. I think it should be done in a way that makes Dr. Ford as comfortable as possible. For example, she says that Judge Kavanaugh not be in the room when she testifies. I think we should honor that request if that makes her more comfortable. But I do think we need to be fair to both and give them both the opportunity to discuss this issue.
So it sounded like after your conversation with Judge Kavanaugh, rather, that you were sort of leaning towards, this guy is not going to touch settled law. Sounds like a really good nominee. What are you thinking now?
Well, first of all, I had not announced a decision on Judge Kavanaugh before this broke last weekend. I should have finished my story that after I read the letter, when I talked to him on Friday, I had a list of issues that I wanted to go through again with him where there were a few outstanding questions. But then I asked him specifically about the letter, and he was very emphatic about his denial. I asked him, did he have any idea who could have written the letter and made the allegations? And he said that he did not. Then on Sunday, the story broke when Dr. Ford decided to come forward. So I just wanted to conclude that story. So I had gone through probably 95% of my deliberation, but as is evident by the fact that I spent an hour talking with him, not just about the anonymous letter, but other issues, I obviously wasn't finished with my analysis. I recognize how important this decision is, and I want to make sure that I've been extremely thorough and diligent in my approach. And do I feel pressure? Sure. But I don't feel pressure to make a decision until I'm ready. And by the way, there are like seven of us that are undecided. It's not just me.
I know, but you, Lisa Murkowski, Senator Lisa Murkowski, Senator Jeff Flake, some of those who have talked about thinking through the decision through in a different way. And this is one of the things that, has happened in politics, people announcing that they're going to vote for the nominee that President Trump puts forward before even knowing who that nominee is.
And people announcing they were going to oppose the nominee before they knew his identity. I don't understand either side on that. I don't understand how you can say, I'm going to vote for or against a nominee whose identity is not yet known. I was just flabbergasted that certain of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle took that approach. There were people with pickets that said, oppose Judge and it had XXX because they didn't know who it was yet. And I don't think that's healthy. We should look at the person.
Well, you talked about the groups, the fringe groups that are pulling things away from the center. But how about the party? How about the role of the party here? This, once elected, the party represents support, allegiance, financial support, and that is critical to a political career moving forward. So what about the party role here in pulling, pushing towards one particular ideology so that somebody says, no matter what the president says, I'm going to vote for him. No matter what the president says, I'm going to vote against his nominee. What's the party role?
Well, the party role for some people is very strong. For some people, it's less strong. I am a New England Republican. That is a very different breed from some of my colleagues from the Deep South, for example. I could never, ever be elected in Alabama to take a state. And I'm not trying to say that's a bad or good thing. It's just I wouldn't reflect that state. You notice I stayed away from Georgia in that example. But, and actually I love,
just as well.
I love Johnny Isaacson, who's a great senator. But in my state, independents control who gets elected. So, and actually, if you look at registration numbers, Republicans rank last in my state. So if I had to depend just on Republicans for votes, I would not be in the United States Senate. And fortunately, Republicans, Democrats, and independents in Maine seem to, thus far, have welcomed an independent approach to the issue. Do I care what the Republican Party thinks? Of course I care. But it does not control my vote. And, you know, I made a very tough decision after my two candidates in the Republican primary did not prevail. I was a Jeb Bush supporter, and then I supported Governor Kasich after Jeb got out of the race. And I wrote an op-ed in August of 2016 saying that I could not support Donald Trump as for president. And I wrote in the name of a Republican for president. So I think I have demonstrated my independence. I will say that despite the fact that I did not support Donald Trump for president, that doesn't mean I disagree with him on every issue. There's some issues where I agree with him. There's some issues where I don't. And I don't hesitate to just exercise my own judgment.
Like, for example, today, he has, up until this point, the president has been showing considerable restraint about the case, wanting to hear from Dr. Ford or offer that option of her having a fair hearing. Today, however, that ended, and he tweeted that, you know, if this was so traumatic to her, why didn't she or her family come back earlier? So when you hear something like that from the president, something that offends your sensibility, your sense of civility, where do you go with that?
Well, this morning I was at an event in Portland, Maine, and it had to do with a new approach to seniors and assisted living, and I'm the chairman of the Aging Committee, and these are issues that matter a great deal to me. But of course, I was asked that question by the press, and I said what I thought, which was that I was appalled that the president put out the tweet, that I did not think that he should have commented, and I thought what he said was inappropriate. Regardless of what the facts of this allegation turn out to be, the fact is that sexual assault is one of the most underreported crimes. So to say that because something wasn't reported, it didn't happen, it should be automatically discredited is not something I would say. And I said publicly that I thought the president should not have said it. In fact, I used the word that I thought it was appalling. So I'm not making a judgment on this particular allegation, but I'm acknowledging what is the truth.
So we have a question here about something about compromise, and I'd love to get to compromise.
I'd love for you to get to it.
Compromise. Well, you know, it's hard to not talk about the thing that's happening, but obviously we do want to look at the big picture, and I think that that's what you're telling us tonight. You know, the big picture is a part of it, not just the event of the day, even though this is a deeply, deeply important vote for many, many people. But, you know, Ronald Reagan famously told Tip O'Neill when he was Speaker of the House that I give you half a loaf today, but then I come back for a half a loaf from you next week. And we have a question here about your compromise on the tax bill. This is a Republican tax bill, and the way that I'm remembering it is that Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, I will promise, you voted for the tax bill. He said that he would pass another bill or present another bill that would mitigate some of the effects of the tax bill by not cutting Medicare, Medicaid. I may be getting this.
Okay.
Am I remembering that
so
properly?
So this
but
is when
that didn't happen.
That's not true. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you asked this, and this is one of the greatest myths in my public service recently. First of all, I supported the tax bill because there were a lot of provisions in it that I agreed with. I liked the doubling of the child tax credit, for example, which would mean that a single mom earning $35,000 a year would get money back, rather because it would be refundable rather than paying money in. I felt that we went too far down on the corporate tax rate, but still, we should not have had the highest corporate tax rate in the world. That puts us at a competitive disadvantage in attracting businesses and creating jobs. I supported the doubling of the standard deduction, which is going to mean a lot of people don't have to itemize and they can simplify. There were four amendments that I filed to the bill. One was the Senate bill, this is less important in New Hampshire, but critical in Maine, had no deduction for state and local taxes. So the House bill did, the Senate bill didn't. That amendment was mine in the Senate. It was adopted. There were other provisions that I put in as well. One was the bill, as drafted in the Senate, would have done away with the deduction for high medical expenses. And I prevailed on that. I prevailed on the other two as well. I was concerned about the impact of the tax bill on two things. One is whether it would trigger a law that would cause a cut in Medicare. And if that were not taken care of, I would not vote for the bill. And that's part of what you're remembering. And indeed, that came to the floor. It was Rand Paul who offered the amendment to keep the cuts that would go into effect automatically in Medicare. I led the opposition to that to protect Medicare, and we overwhelmingly prevailed. The other issue was a commitment that I had from Mitch McConnell that a bipartisan bill that I authored with Bill Nelson to set up reinsurance pools, to high-risk pools, to help lower the cost of the premiums of the Affordable Care Act on the individual market would be brought up for a vote on the government funding bill. And indeed, it was, along with a companion bill by Lamar Alexander. It was brought up on the floor. Senator McConnell kept his commitment to me, And much to my surprise, it was blocked by a member of the Democratic leadership from getting a vote. So because it didn't get a vote, people think that the issue never came up. That's not true. It did come up. And I am astounded that there was not unanimous support for this, because we had analysis done by a well-respected actuarial firm that said that it would have resulted in premiums on the individual market being as much as 40% lower over the next 2 years, which would have been a huge relief to individuals who buy insurance on the individual market because they don't have employer-provided insurance, and they make just a little bit too much, over 400% of the poverty level, to qualify for the tax credits under the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I think this question made the same assumption that I did, that you had some ironclad, I think the
quote was, and Mitch McConnell brought up,
but it was your Republican colleagues that didn't pick it up. That's the perception here. But the question, I think, stands, how does that, when you exchange loaves, how does that affect your willingness to compromise when it doesn't work? When does the compromise not work?
Well, I tried earlier this year to negotiate an agreement on an immigration issue that has to do with what's called the DACA program. These are young children who are brought to this country by their parents. It was the parents who made the decision. The average age is either age 4 or age 6, I can't remember which, that these children were brought here. And I tried to broker an agreement where we would give the administration some money for border security, including sensors, some money for building parts of the wall, extra border patrol, and in return, there would be an agreement that this population of young people, one of which I talked to in Maine, didn't even know that he wasn't a citizen of the United States, because he'd come here from El Salvador at age 4 and had no memory at all of his native land. Found out when he was going to apply for a driver's license, and his parents said, you know, there's a little something we need to tell you. And so it would have given this group of young people, a path to citizenship. They would have to meet all sorts of requirements, but it would have given them a pathway to citizenship, because they weren't responsible for making the decision to break the law. Well, I put together a group of about, it grew to 26 senators, Democrats and Republicans, and my colleague Angus King, and we negotiated, and we finally reached this hard-fought deal. And the agreement was a good one, and we needed 60 votes to go forward. I had a commitment from the leader to bring it to the floor. There were two alternatives. One was the president's plan, which did not have a path to citizenship and was focused on the wall, and also changing some other immigration laws. And then there was a plan to our left, a more liberal plan. And the night before I had the 60 votes that were needed in the Senate, and then the day of what happened is the Department of Homeland Security put out this press release, which completely misrepresented what the bill contained. And this was very disappointing to me. This was done, I should say, by the White House and the Secretary. There are so many fine people who work for the Department of Homeland Security, so I don't want to be implying that I'm tarring the departments. since I helped create it in the first place in particular. But it just, it said it created a new amnesty program, and it had lots of loaded words, and it misrepresented the bill. The president threatened to veto it. And when the vote came, and I had just 60, so I was vulnerable to start with, I ended up with, I believe it was either 54 or 56 votes, but I lost Republican votes after that came out. Now, I will say with great pride that I got far more votes on the proposal that I negotiated than either the plan to the left or the plan to the right. And you know, you have to try. You can't just say, just because it doesn't always work, you can't say, well, that's that, you know, I'm not gonna try anymore. And a lot of times my efforts have worked, whether it's reopening government in the shutdown, that's when I first put together the Common Sense Coalition. And believe me, the leaders of the Senate were not real happy to have this rump group coming up with a plan to reopen government. But eventually they took our plan, tweaked it a bit, and reopened government after a 16-day shutdown. And I think government shutdowns represent the ultimate failure to govern. And that's why I felt so strongly about that. But I can go to my work with Joe Lieberman to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That was really hard to get past, but we did it. When I was a brand new senator, I remember joining forces with Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, and we repealed a $50 billion tax break for the tobacco industry that had been sneaked in to a bill. And I remember giving a floor statement on this and saying that it happened at midnight, and the author of it came up to me, furious at me, but his only argument, it did not happen at midnight, which I didn't find exactly compelling. So sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I think when you can come up with a compromise, and I don't think compromise is a dirty word, when you can identify common ground, it is apt to be a better solution because you've listened to both sides, and also it's apt to have greater support in our country. And I think that's really important, and we've lost sight of that. It's been so exacerbated by social media, by cable, television, reinforcing views that people already have. It's like everyone should listen to the other side occasionally. They might even find that they agree occasionally. And that's what we've lost right now in this country.
Well, we do have to wrap, but there are so many questions here about, you know, you've made it very clear that you do not, as a woman senator, and the senior-most woman senator, base your views or make judgments based on your gender. However, there are so many people have asked, like, what is your depth of commitment to important women's issues? How would you like to hear, we would like to hear how the Republican Party has made efforts to improve the lives of women, specifically women. What would it take for you as a woman to protect women and vote against Judge Kavanaugh? So I will reframe that question as what will it take for you to vote no or yes on women?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question.
I had to try.
I've right? answered every other question, but I'm not going to answer that one. But I do want to answer the question about women's senators. I am the senior Republican woman senator, and Dianne Feinstein is the senior Democratic woman senator. And the women senators do have, or have had, a special bond, and we get together for dinner about once a month. I remember a few years ago, one of my older male colleagues saying, I hear you had another one of those dinners last night. And I said, yes. I was riding over on the subway with him for a vote. And he says, well, what do you talk about? And I just smiled sweetly and I said, we planned the coup. And
so I think it's appropriate to end civility and compromise with a coup as we thank Senator Susan Collins so
thank
much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you again. Very great interview. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Before I go tonight, I just want to point out that two members of my staff are graduates of St. A's. So, and they're terrific. So my thanks to the college, to President DeSalvo, to Joe McQuaid, who also wrote me a letter inviting me to the Council on Civics, and to you also for your tough questions tonight, and to all of you for coming. This is the kind of dialogue that I really enjoy. So thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. My I just wanted to say hello. Really glad to have you here tonight. It's a great honor. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.